Hello, book lovers! I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. To start the show, we're delving into a book that's just out and getting a ton of buzz with insiders in the publishing world. It's for our Book Biz segment, and the book is about the changing role of literary agents. Later in the hour, we'll talk to Tolani Alcanola about her brand new debut novel, Leave Your Mess at Home. This novel brings us to Chicago and introduces us to a Nigerian-American family set on a crash course towards each other. The novel asks, what do we owe our families and what do we owe ourselves? Tolani Alcanola is part of Reese's Book Club Fellowship Program, and I'm really excited to talk to her about what that means and this beautiful new debut novel. Up first, the Book Biz. This is where we look at the forces shaping what gets written, published, and read. And today we're talking to Laura B. McGrath. She's an English professor at Temple University, and she just published a book all about literary agents. It's called Middlemen, Literary Agents and the Making of American Fiction. Welcome, Laura. I'm so excited to have you on the show today and really pull back the cover on the publishing market. What happens behind the scenes?
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel. I am so thrilled to be here.
So let's start with the basics. What is a literary agent? Because I think a lot of people really confuse that with a publisher or editor. So what is an agent?
A literary agent is an author's representative, both financially and also aesthetically. They will represent an author's work by pitching it to publishers and selling it, and managing an author's career over the long term. So helping them figure out where they should place short pieces, how they should present themselves to the world, and how one book can build on another to make someone not just a professional writer, but a capital A author.
I love that description because you really got into, right, it's not just that they sell the book, it's the whole career when you have the right agent, right? And it's a conversation back and forth, and really they are the middlemen, as you say. What prompted this book? Why write about agents, literary agents?
When I was doing my PhD in American literature, I noticed that there was this real gap between what literary historians cared about when we think about how authors have published their books and how the books that are on our syllabi or in the literary canon came to be, and a real gap between what we historians cared about and what actual working writers cared about. So we historians might care a lot about editors. We might care a lot about MFA programs. We might care a lot about, you know, even the literal book binding. But if you ask any author who's working today, all they want to gossip about, all they want to talk about, all that they want to complain about is who's represented by whom, how they could possibly get a literary agent, whether or not their agent is doing the right job. I mean, there is such an obsession around literary agents if you talk to writers today. And so I wanted to figure out why we're interested in two different things and why it is that scholars haven't bothered to care about this and why it is that writers are so obsessed.
I can tell you that is 100% accurate in what I see because I have emerging authors on this show and I talk to a lot of emerging authors, and always conversations get to who's your agent?
Always, always.
How did you find her? Right? What, you know, what is she doing? Do you like her? Are you staying? What are you doing? So yes, that is spot on. So do you have an agent?
I do. I'm represented by Aliyah Hannah Habib at the Gurnett Company, who actually just released her own book in this wonderful meta moment in earlier this winter in February.
Wow. And really quick, just so people, our listeners, have a sense of how this book came together, what kind of research did you do as you looked into agents?
This book was so challenging to research because agents really love to stay behind the curtain. They are not public figures, for as much as writers are obsessed with them. They keep their work very close to the chest. So to get into this research, I spent some time in the archives looking at letters between authors and agents historically, but that didn't yield very much. It was not the same as researching these really thick archives from editors. So I spent the past 10 years doing fieldwork and talking talking to more than 75 literary agents. I met them in their offices, and I met them at bars or over coffee. I went to parties to try to figure out how they think about books and how they work. I got to look through some slush piles with agents. I got to sit in on a 3-martini lunch where there were, to my sadness, no martinis consumed. And I got to go to the Frankfurt Book Fair and see how books get bought and sold internationally. It was so much fun.
I love it. That sounds amazing. I should also tell listeners that I also have an agent. I'm with Kim Witherspoon at Inkwell. I'm talking to Laura B. McGrath about her brand new book, Middlemen, Literary Agents and the Making of American Fiction. You say in this book, Laura, that the book agents are the first and most consequential gatekeepers of the publishing world. There are over 1,000 of them here in the U.S., and really not all agents are created equal. There are different levels of agents, and they are these gatekeepers. Let's talk about that for a minute.
I think people really misunderstand the word gatekeeper. We tend to think of it as someone who keeps people out and who hoards power and hoards their knowledge and tries to keep everything under control by refusing to give it to others or refusing to share it with others. And a lot of aspiring writers think about agents that way, as people who are, you know, designed to keep them out, who are not going to find their work in the slush pile, who are going to, you know, really destroy their dreams by saying no to them someday. But I like to think about agents as gatekeepers, as people who open gates, as people who let writers into the literary field, who show them which path to take and how to get there and introduce them to the right people who can help them along the way. And in that way, agents are gatekeepers. They're also advocates by really throwing their weight and their reputations behind the work that they believe in.
But I really want to push on this. Not all agents are created equal, right? There is a concentration of power at the top of the hierarchy.
Yes, absolutely. About 25 agents represent over half of the novelists that have been shortlisted for major literary prizes in the 21st century. So just as we see a real concentration of prestige amongst writers, maybe if you went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, we see a real concentration of prestige amongst literary agents too, whether that is agents who are representing the very small number of writers who can receive over $250,000 in a book advance, who will be commercially floating the big five houses, or the writers who are routinely recognized for their literary quality and their literary achievement by winning things like the Pulitzer Prize, things like the National Book Award, et cetera. There's really only a few agents who are there at the locus of power and who are ultimately going to be affecting not only what we as readers are accessing regularly, but also what I am going to be teaching in an English classroom in 20 years.
It's so crazy to think about that, right? Agents are these silent power brokers, right? We don't think about them. We don't talk about them. You really only see them in the acknowledgments in books. And yet they are these gatekeepers, opening, closing, whatever you want to think of it, right? It's so crazy to me. But publishing is changing. And the way that authors and books are getting out there is changing. So I really want to drill down and push back on agents and ask, what is their core function, right? What is it that they do that no one can replace?
A lot of the functions that an agent performs, things like negotiating a book deal, things like negotiating the finer points of a contract, that is not unique to literary agents. A lawyer could do that, an entertainment manager can do that, and lots of writers have found that working with a lawyer or working with a manager is a better choice for them. But what an agent does that is very specific to the role of the literary agent is they know all of the editors. They know not only who likes what and who wants what, but they also know who's going to work best with whom. What editor is going to be the right fit for the right writer and ultimately going to be best for the project. So in agents' work, the way that they exercise their taste and the way that they function as matchmakers is really very bespoke, personalized, dedicated service that is based on a lifetime of professional networking. And it's that's the reason why you pay a literary agent.
And the flat fee is usually, it's just 15%. An agent takes 15%.
Correct. An agent takes 15% of a commission, and no agent that is worth their salt will ever ask you to pay for their services. Never pay for an agent.
Or a read or anything like that, right? Their commission is the 15%. But I really want to push on this because on this show, we have talked about the test and scale model, where a lot of authors are self-publishing. They're going out there through Kindle Unlimited or their whatever means they're using, right? They're getting out there, they're selling tons of books, and then they're being picked up by traditional publishers. So in that world, do you need an agent?
That world is a really interesting one to me. It's one that I've been spending a lot of time on. I think those big success stories that we hear of, right? People like Hugh Howey, people like Rachel Reed, people like E.L. James, they're achieving a level of mega success, and then they're going back into trad publishing. So they're still relying on these agents as gatekeepers, even if they've built and proven their audience somewhere else. I think the idea that self-publishing is this disruptive force to the publishing industry is a whole lot of Silicon Valley snake oil. I think that it is based in the libertarian idea that we could somehow give control back to the hands of the creator, when in actuality, self-publishing is just as gatekept as traditional publishing is. There are just as many gatekeepers, except that they are algorithms and not people.
Let's talk about Sourcebooks and Bloom Books, right? So they are the ultimate test and scale model. They have used that model to become one of the biggest publishers, right, out there. And they are picking up these test and scale authors who have published, self-published, sold 10,000, 8,000, 15,000 copies on their own. And then they are building a business. They're not buying up the e-rights, but they're taking the traditional, the paper rights, if you will, for hardback, sprayed edges, special editions, right? I mean, that's not really snake oil in the same way, is it?
In the Kindle Direct model, I think it is. It's appealing to different sorts of algorithms and different sorts of readership models when you are testing. And those things are being controlled by someone else. Those are not being controlled by writers. You may have tested by figuring out how best to appeal to those particular algorithms of popularity and discovery that are constantly changing, that writers are constantly finding themselves having to adapt their own test and scale models.
So do agents' incentives always align with the authors, especially in this new world of publishing?
I don't know as much about the test and scale model. My research for this book really has not included as much of these agents who are doing their sourcing through places like Kindle Direct or places like Wattpad, because I've been interested in the agents that are really focused on prestige literature. And they're still relying on things like short story collections and MFA programs to source their work, as well as referral. So my research isn't as much focused on that particular question. So in the test and scale model, it's not entirely clear to me how agents' incentives do align with authors or do align with these other companies. But in the traditional model, yes, an agent's incentives ultimately align with an author's incentives, which is ultimately the book, right? Which means that sometimes an agent will tell an author, look, your best idea, this thing that you're really committed to, that's not really in the interest of the book, right? That's not ultimately going to get us to the end point that we want to get us to. And our interests are aligned for the best possible book, which means that an agent is not always going to be an author's yes man, right? They're not always going to be an author's attack dog going out and doing precisely what the author wants to do. But because they are all committed to the best possible book and the best long-term career, they're bringing their expert knowledge to bear in the way that they represent the author and the decisions that they're making on a daily basis for the book.
I want to go back to short stories. You mentioned short stories very briefly. Short stories are this weird sort of marketing tool for writers, right? Because it's sort of like if you can get a short story into The New Yorker, then you might get someone's attention, either an agent or an editor, and you might be able to sell a book or a short story collection. But short stories don't actually make any money. But that's how you market yourself. Let's talk about that strange dynamic.
Short stories are this very weird form in American literature because there has never really been a market for the short story collection. And the short story itself has really risen and fallen. Its currency has really risen and fallen with the magazine market in the United States. It was really the foundation of much of commercial American literature for much of the 18th and 19th centuries. And now here in the 20th century and 21st, it means very little. So the short story is always doing something else, whether it's trying to get an agent's attention or trying to establish the author's reputation in a very particular subset of the literary community. Right? The short story is really for the very literary, capital L, literary writers. It's not really going to do as much work for the genre fiction writers or the more commercial fiction writers. So for a writer, a short story collection that comes out of an MFA program is something like an audition. Right? It's a great way to get an agent's attention. It's a great way to show what you're capable of and what you're interested in, but also to show off your craft chops because you're able to do it in a very compressed, tight space.
And yet short story collections basically never pay out, right? If you get an advance, you're never earning out of that.
Right. Short story collections are not profitable forms in and of themselves. There's not a huge readership for it. And so they serve two other functions. One, they are a really great way of establishing the literary bona fides of a writer and suggesting that this is a writer who is invested in standing the test of time. This is a writer whose skill, whose literary expertise, whose artistic quality is another level of timelessness that they don't need to depend on the market in quite the same way. But for an agent, likewise, it is the hardest possible sale that they can make. It is the hardest possible sale on any given year. There are fewer literary short story collections published than any other genre. And so for an agent to represent them, to say, I am going to commit myself and my energy and my reputation to something that is not strictly about money, is a really great way for the agent to tell us what type of agent they are and what type of impact on the literary world they hope to have.
We're talking to Laura B. McGrath about her brand new book, Middlemen, Literary Agents and the Making of American Fiction. Laura, there's so much packed into this super short interview, so much I want to talk about. But you mentioned that some authors have found they don't want to work with agents. They want to work strictly with attorneys or managers of some sort. And that is fascinating to me. These authors, like, who are they? What kind of authors are they? And what are they losing without their agents?
One of the biggest authors who did this historically was Philip Roth, actually. He fired his longtime agent, Candida Donadio, because he thought, I have a good enough relationship with my editor. I do not need her to take 10% of every single book deal. And what Philip Roth found was that this was actually a really bum deal for him because he didn't have an agent who was fighting for him. His lawyers were happy to put through a fairly standard boilerplate contract, and Philip Roth lost a lot of money by doing that. And ultimately, he ended up going back to hire another agent, Andrew Wiley, who was able to advocate for him, for his deals, both domestically and internationally, because he had the expert knowledge that comes from being inside the industry. That's what you have with an agent that you don't necessarily have with a lawyer or with a manager, is someone who knows the ins and outs of the industry, who knows that it's more than just about money, but it's always also about personal taste and about the right people being involved with the project.
Wow. So I know you said you haven't done much research into today's market. Yours is more historical. You're an academic. And I love that. I love looking back. But do you have any sense about what the role of agents might be in 2036? Are we going to see more of these self-published authors with attorneys? Because a lot of deals are coming to them, right? They don't have to necessarily go out. What is your prediction?
Some of the things I'm looking at for agencies moving forward is I'm looking at the way that smaller boutique agencies are being bought up by the large mega conglomerate agencies, places like WME, places like CAA. And so I'm really interested in the ways that those sorts of mergers and acquisitions are facilitating more back office multimedia adaptation deals for writers. That's something that's really interesting to me, to look at the way that back office merger might create a different sort of look on the front list or a different sort of idea of what it might mean to be an author who gets a film deal, for instance, or to think about the relationship between an audiobook narrator and a film adaptation, for instance, or a limited series adaptation. So that's one thing I'm paying a lot of attention to moving forward. I'm also really interested in the way that the functions of editorial have shifted. So there's a trend in which editors are spending less time editing, and writers complain about this all the time, that writers don't edit, and that's not true, but there are more and more demands that are being made on editors' time. And so the editorial work is being displaced. Often agents are doing a ton more editorial work before a book even goes to sale than anyone realizes. And in recognition of this, several agencies have been hiring their own in-house editorial directors, recognizing that the editorial demands that are being placed on agents are too great for them, too. So I'm increasingly interested in the bespoke editorial roles that are happening in houses, in agencies, agencies, but also looking at the really creative models that agents are adapting to make sure that their authors get the sort of editorial oversight and bespoke attention that they need for a book to be successful now.
That is fascinating. So what you might get from an agent 10 years from now is editorial services.
And you get editorial services from an agent now. I think that is one thing that people really underestimate, whether it's in fiction and an agent is working on a manuscript with you. I mean, the biggest gatekeeping role that agents play is they're the ones that determine when a book is ready to go to sale, right? An author doesn't do that. An agent decides, this book is now ready. I will take this to editors now. And so to make that happen, agents are often requesting significant manuscript revisions. They are really getting in on the page with writers in a way that I don't think any writer quite expects when they sign with an agent.
Laura McGrath, thank you so much for joining me today here on the Book Biz segment of Check This Out.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having me. This has been a pleasure.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My next guest is Tolani Akinola, and we are going to talk about her brand new debut novel, Leave Your Mess at Home. In this novel, we meet four estranged Nigerian-American siblings in Chicago who are forced to confront family secrets and resentments at a very dramatic Thanksgiving reunion. The novel asks, what do we owe our families and what do we owe ourselves? Welcome, Tolani. I'm so excited to have you here on Check This Out.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Your debut focuses on the Longay family. They are four siblings born to Nigerian immigrants, and they are a mess. The book is called Leave Your Mess at Home. They are on a crash course towards each other, and they collide at the Thanksgiving table. Set us up. Tell us, what is this book about, Leave Your Mess at Home?
The novel set during a single autumn in Chicago, and basically over that time, over about like 8 to 12 weeks, each of the siblings is beginning to wrestle with how dysfunctional their family is. Their eldest estranged sister returns to the city for the first time in years, which really forces each of the siblings to reckon with things and examine how their family dynamic is informed the ways that they are loving in the relationships that they are trying to find their way into, out of, maintaining in their adult lives.
So on the surface, it's about these four siblings, and they are a mess. And you take us through about a two-month slice of their life. What are you really trying to get at? Like, what's this book really about?
Ooh, I think it is about the pressure to have, like, put on a good face in the world and, like, seem like you have it all together, even when you don't. I feel like for a lot of second-generation Nigerians, you know, there's this, like, idea of, oh, like, Nigerian excellence. And, you know, I was interested in, like, exploring what the cost of the process of, like, achieving so much is and, like, how much pressure that can exact on people, and interested in exploring especially like the internecine conflicts that I think exist within the Black community when you have Black immigrants coming into this country, and the kinds of biases that we and, you know, judgments that we make about each other.
And you just touched on one of the big themes that I really want to talk about within the Black community, the conflict between different pieces, different parties where people have come from different backgrounds. So are you second generation Nigerian American?
Oh, yes, I am. Born on Long Island to Nigerian immigrants. So I very much like wrote my experience into this book.
Okay. I felt like it was that personal. Like, I felt like this had to be part of your life in some way to know all of this. Tolani Akinola, to introduce us to your beautiful debut, Leave Your Mess at Home, would you read for us?
Yes. When Anjola takes her seat on the Blue Line train, Sola's words are replaying in her mind. Knowing what she wants out of life is a hard thing. If she had to describe what she's done so far, to say, a blank face God on Judgment Day, she thinks she would say it's mostly been a mixture of what she's been told to do and what seems right. Want is something else entirely. She thinks back to that graduation dinner, that first time she felt the weight of her parents' disapproval. The pursuit of elite status and the vocation of providing care are fundamentally at odds, Anjola had said to her mother, trying to explain why she was moving back home to Chicago, why she had ranked its most notorious public hospital at the top of her list for her residency training. The explanation didn't land. But Anjola, you're so brilliant. You told me your test scores were good. Why Cook County of all places? Her mother asked. What happened? Her voice was soft and grave, as though she were inquiring about the reason behind a sad misfortune. I want to be where I can do the most good, Anjola said. At the admission that Anjola had done this to herself, that this was not the result of her enemies conspiring against her, Anjola's mother's voice took on a new hardness. What good do you think you'll be doing there? Shalei Fumi, she demanded. They won't be able to give you the same caliber of training that any of these other programs would. They'll just be working you like a mule. Her mother, a healthcare provider herself, was the only other person at the table who could have understood the predicament in which Anjola had placed herself. And nearly 6 months in, with this residency program proving to be every bit as grueling as her mother warned, Anjola has begun to question whether she came back to Chicago out of genuine desire or some strange sense of morality.
Okay, amazing. That was Tolani Akinola reading from her brand new debut, Leave Your Mess at Home. So she just introduced us to the first sibling, Anjola, and she graduated from Yale Medical School and comes back to Chicago to work in a hard neighborhood and a hard hospital, and she chooses it because she feels like she needs to pay it back or pay it forward, but she is so overburdened with pressure and expectations. Let's talk about that. Can you tell us about Anjola and what she's feeling?
Yeah, I think Anjola is, you know, she is the family's third child, and very much within this family dynamic, like, plays a bit of a people-pleasing role. She's very brilliant and also a bit emotionally disconnected. So she's really fun to write in that way because I sometimes felt like I know what she's feeling, but she doesn't know what she's feeling. And how do I convey that on the page? In this particular scene on the train, she is thinking about this decision to have come back to Chicago and work at Stroger Hospital. And, you know, as someone who kind of has done everything that she's been expected to do up until this point, as a child of Nigerian immigrants, she's gone to the University of Chicago, she's gone to Yale Medical School. The idea is like the upward trajectory should only continue. The idea that she like decides that it is more in alignment with her values to prioritize being at this public hospital than to be at some prestigious private hospital for a residency training is like her first like known instance of like doing something that is like overtly against her mother's wishes.
I want to dig into Sola. She was actually my favorite character. She's completely unlikable and lovable all at the same time. Before we dive into her, I need to let listeners know that there are scenes in the novel that include domestic violence and violence. If you or someone you know needs help, you can call 1-800-799-SAFE. That's S-A-F-E, 1-800-799-SAFE. All right, let's talk about Sola, because this novel, your beautiful debut, Leave Your Mess at Home, starts off when Sola comes back to Chicago and sort of secretly comes back and starts, you know, slowly getting back into her siblings' lives until she comes to the Thanksgiving dinner. So let's talk about Sola. Can you just give us a brief overview of that character?
Yes, I can. Sola is the family's eldest daughter, but she's the second child of the family. And when we meet her at the beginning of the novel, she's just returned to Chicago after having left the city for about a decade. And in that decade had achieved like a modicum of success as a social media influencer. She like lived in LA and profited off of, you know, displaying her interracial love story on YouTube, and that kind of all blows up in her face, and she decides to pack up and move back to Chicago. So I think then over the course of the novel, we start to see her become more embedded within the structure of this family again, and her path, I guess, back to them is also like an example of a very like fraught path of reconciliation. She is the child who I would say has been most wronged by this family dynamic. as a child. And sorry if I'm dropping a spoiler here. She's molested as a child and then doesn't have anyone she can turn to. And her mother, as I think, because Sola is the first daughter of the family, the eldest daughter, has ridiculous expectations of her. And Sola is partially due to her personality and having survived this kind of trauma is unwilling to capitulate to a lot of these expectations.
Yeah. So when we first meet Sola, I don't really like her. And then we sort of learn these bits and pieces you feed us slowly that make me start to love her and feel so bad for her. And you mentioned that she was involved in an interracial relationship and she tried to be an influencer. And as a Black woman, she got no followers, just doing her own thing. No one was interested in what she was doing. But as a piece of an interracial couple, she got all kinds of fame and endorsements, right? And so when she loses that, she loses everything. You mentioned that one of the big themes is, you know, beef within the Black community and what that all means. There's a lot about race buried in that description of her part of her life. Please tell me about that and why you chose to highlight that.
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes, like, when you're writing a novel, you are obviously choosing things, but, like, it also is, like, the story is coming to you in a sense, and so it doesn't feel like you're choosing things. So I say that to say that, like, at the time that I had written the novel, for most of my 20s, when I would go on social media, on YouTube, I would be bombarded with so much content, especially from Black beauty influencers, about their interracial relationships as well. And these things seem to go, like, be hand in hand. And I feel like it was a spectacle. It was a source of, like, public fascination. And I found that rather curious. And so I think that's how that kind of arc worked its way into this novel in particular.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Last season, we spoke to Zenobi Purvis about her debut novel, The Hounding. That novel has since been named an Indies Choice Awards finalist. It was also named a Best Book of the Year by NPR, Time, and Kirkus. If you haven't read her book yet, check it out and listen to the episode wherever you get your podcasts or on nhpr.org. My guest today is Tolani Akinola, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, Leave Your Mess at Home. So we know, as we get deeper and deeper into your book, that all of the strife is sort of concentrated around this one event that happened with Sola, the centering event for the family, this moment that their mother finds these photographs, a vase breaks, her mother hits her, right? It's this horrific scene. Can you just set that up for us, and then we'll talk some more about it?
Yeah, so it is a memory that each of the siblings have and is something that I think allows you to see the different ways that a single event can be remembered and understood, even if witnessed by four different people. But effectively, when Sola is a teenager, she has put somewhat provocative pictures on MySpace, and those pictures are shared around her school. Her mother gets word of this from the principal, and as someone with a very conservative sexual ethic, is very upset about Sola's behavior. She thinks that she has decided to send the pictures around the school. So she comes home and beats her. And each of the siblings, like the other three siblings, witness this.
And the big question is, why didn't anyone stop the mother from beating her? And this is the moment where the family really splits. Sola leaves for 10 years after this. Tolani, can you tell us more about this moment and how it affects everybody for the next 10 years?
Yeah, so in this particular event, Ola, the oldest brother, Sola's elder sibling, is in the basement with Karen, the youngest. They hear a glass break, they run upstairs. And in that moment, one would think that Ola, especially because he's a fully grown adult at this point in time, would see that there's something very wrong with this and, say, Mom, you have to stop this or you can't do this. But instead, the mother kind of asks him to, back her up. And he does. And he says, you can't do things like this. You're a representation of our family. I think that's very telling about Ola's character. As to why no one intervenes, I think it is a testament to just how like entrenched the hierarchy within this family is. Like the mother is kind of this unbending influence in the family. And so they don't even think to question her behavior.
And it's so disturbing. I mean, for me, it really set up the dynamic of the family and really outlined it. Talani, your characters in your debut novel, Leave Your Mess at Home, they're messy and they're unlikable in some ways. They're very lovable in other ways. How did you give yourself permission to get so messy? Like, was there ever a point where you thought, oh, I don't know if I can do this? Or did you just go for it?
A mixture of both. Like, there were scenes in the novel that I was like, this is too messy. Like, what will people think about me because of how messy these characters are and like these, you know, very, very toxic ways that some of them are behaving. But I think ultimately, like, sometimes the most cringe emotion that you're experiencing as you write, it's like, it's there because it's true. Like, it's hinting at something true and something that you're maybe resistant towards exploring because of all of, you know, the worry about how people might perceive you or even like what it might cause you to have to reckon with in yourself. So as much as like, I feel like the writing process of writing fiction is like a mirror, like holding up a mirror to the world around you. It's also like holding up a mirror at yourself.
Let's talk about another one of the big themes here that we've touched on very briefly, which is inter-Black relationships in America and how, you know, as a Nigerian American, your characters are seen next to other Black characters. And I really want to look at that through Anjola. And she is completely in love with Neil, her best friend. And you show us some amazing scenes between them. So tell us about Anjola and Neil's different backgrounds.
Anjola is Nigerian American. She kind of comes from a working class background. Her father drives a taxi. Her mom is a nurse. And Neil is Black American, but comes from a wealthy family, which I think in the Black American experience is like more of a rarity than it is for white people, but like wealthy Black Americans do exist. It was interesting, like exploring the, I guess, like the intersections of their privileges in these different ways. So
I love that description because it perfectly sets up one of the tensions in the book and one of the themes, which is this strife between Black Americans and the Nigerian or immigrant communities. And you show that in a scene between these two characters, Anjola and Neil, when Anjola goes to a dinner party with him. Could you read for us and really show us this in scene?
Sure, I'd love to.
Brief context for listeners. Anjola is at a dinner party with Neil, sitting next to a family friend, and a man next to her turns and starts to talk about medical school.
Yale, huh? That's quite an accomplishment. He leans forward now, his forearms resting on the table, hands clasped together. And where are your people from? Nigeria, she says. That sounds about right. Anjola looks down at her hands, feeling her chest tighten again. She has been in several iterations of a conversation to follow, and they never end with good feelings. It's just always funny to me how Black immigrants make up the majority of the Black student population at these Ivy League schools, he begins. Seems to me like all these quotas and affirmative action policies were set up to benefit everyone but we Black American folk. She nods silently. She has no desire to speak. Now see, for a Black American male to get into an institution like Harvard or Yale, his ancestors would have had to have survived several generations of slavery, Jim Crow, the Civil Rights era, the crack epidemic, the war on drugs. He takes a sip of water. What else? A century of disenfranchisement, redlining, stop and frisk. You're not wrong, Anjola says. I know I'm not wrong, the man says. Actually, you're a little bit wrong. Neil pushes up his glasses, folds his hands neatly on the table.
Talani, this is a really powerful passage because what you're setting up here is the Nigerian or Black immigrant community versus Black American folk, as the character in your book calls it. Can you talk to me about this dynamic and why you want to explore that in this book?
I think that Blackness in America is not monolithic, and As Black immigration has continued from, especially from West Africa and Caribbean countries as well, and the face of Blackness becomes more expansive in this country, how do we acknowledge that there are these differences and account for them? I don't know if I necessarily have an answer for these questions, but I do think that they're really interesting. I think, like, even in this discussion, you see the ways in which there can be these, like, resentments at play, and also sometimes a lack of acknowledgement on the part of Black immigrants for what the Black American struggle in the U.S. really has been. And, you know, in my experience, I've often heard Black immigrants say, like, oh, you know, Black Americans, they don't work hard enough. You know, they're lazy. And it's, you know, these are really prejudiced ideas. Also, to me, they seem like very akin to white racist rhetoric. And, you know, on the other side, I think there are fears of, like, replacement, that I can understand why they're there. But sometimes, you know, arguments from Black Americans can veer a little bit xenophobic as well. And there can be also a lack of acknowledgement of the totalizing brutality as well of the, like, colonial project. So it's complicated. And I just, like, seeing complicated things on the page.
If you're just joining me, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. We're talking to Tolani Akinola about her brand new debut, Leave Your Mess at Home. In this passage that you just read, Tolani, what really struck me, I mean, so many things, but Anjola says she's been in several iterations of the conversation to follow, and they never end with good feelings. I mean, just that sentence alone is very powerful, that it's happened to her again and again. This is not the first time she's hearing this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've seen this conversation play out in many different spheres and, you know, in media and one-on-one conversation. So I think it is something that, like, Black people in this country are wrestling with and thinking about is important. But yeah, I think the extent to which this conversation continues to involve, like, deploying stereotypes and a lack of willingness to understand and hear the other perspective, like, they will never end in good feelings. So
let's talk about this question of, where are you leaving your mess? Can you talk to me about that title?
Yes. I think, you know, home for this family is, you know, is fraught. It's like, is home about the house that, you know, they all grew up in? Is home about the city? Is home about the people, the relationships in their lives? Is it about, like, this country or their parents' home country? I like this title. I think it really works on multiple levels because, you know, it can speak to this idea of Americans kind of having a pejorative attitude to the cultures of immigrants. It's kind of like, leave your mess over there in your home country. This idea also of, you know, when I leave home, I need to be put together. And so how do I, as a child of immigrants, like, appear to be accomplished and have, you know, just have my life together? You know, this idea also that the mess you leave at home is something you eventually have to deal with, and the dysfunction at the core of this family dynamic. And I think the fact that these siblings do not leave the mess at home, they very much carry it with them out into the world.
In your novel, Leave Your Mess at Home, you really seem to be asking about the four siblings, the Lange siblings. What do they owe their family? Do they owe them anything? Or is it time for them to break free of this, you know, very hard family that they've lived in and just be out there for themselves?
Isn't that the question, the eternal question? It's so hard to answer. And I think for, you know, anyone, the question of, like, what do you owe your family? What do you owe yourself as an individual is, like, something that is resonant. But particularly for children of immigrants who are dealing with this idea that, you know, your parents have sacrificed so much and, like, lost so much so that you could live in a country that is safer, you know, more economically fruitful, provides you more opportunities. Like, what do you then owe this family dynamic? So it feels like an increased burden in a sense. But, you know, I think at the time that I sat down to write this novel, I was like, yeah, you don't owe your family anything. Like, ditch your family. But I don't know if I feel that way anymore. I think, though, that the idea that you owe your family your entire life and, you know, you owe your family, like, your willingness to live out their version of success, I don't necessarily believe that. But I think that there is a, like, you know, family is like a unit of belonging. And I feel like there's a responsibility to that in the sense of, like, you know, we owe each other the willingness to show up as we really are and, like, try and love each other despite what we might not love in one another. And I think that that's probably it.
Along those same lines, if we owe this responsibility to each other to show up and try to love each other as we are, which I love that idea, is forgiveness possible? Because some of these characters in your book, Leave This Mess at Home, have done some bad things to each other. Is forgiveness possible?
I do think forgiveness is possible. I don't think it's owed.
I love that distinction. I love that. It's possible, but not owed.
Definitely. You know, I grew up in a Christian family, and so this idea of, like, you know, you should forgive as God forgave you, like, it very much felt like a divine edict. But I feel like as I've gotten older, like, that idea doesn't seem fair to me, that, like, you are obligated to forgive people. I think that instead I think of it as, like, it's a gift that you can bestow if you choose to, but you don't have to.
Talani, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the lead up to publication of your book, Leave Your Mess at Home. You are a Reese's Book Club Lit Up Fellow. Congratulations. That's amazing. Tell us about that. What is that program?
Thank you so much. So Lit Up is a fellowship through Reese's Book Club that helps underrepresented women writers kind of find their footing in publishing. So they'll choose a cohort of about 5 to 6 women writers who write across many different genres and pair each of us with a published author mentor. So mine is Curtis Sittenfeld, which has been incredible to be her mentee. Lit Up provides like a week-long retreat in which you get to learn about the ins and outs of the publishing industry. So things like, how do you query an agent, to how do publishing advances work? You know, essential knowledge that actually I don't think a lot of writers get. And then Reese's Book Club also supports Lit Up authors with like marketing support. And so I think just having the Reese's Book Club name attached to my manuscript when I was submitting it to agents and then submitting it to editors at publishing houses, like, I think it made a huge difference. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
Reese's Book Club, of course, is Reese Witherspoon's book club.
Yes.
And Hello Sunshine Group. And she has just done so much for authors. It's amazing. Just incredible. Did being a part of this Lit Up Fellows group, did it make you change what you thought was possible for your career?
Yes. So when I applied to Lit Up, I'd had 2 drafts of this novel done and maybe was trying to work on a third revision. And then, you know, was kind of in a place of, I don't know if this can ever become anything. Obviously, I've read many amazing books over the years. And so I was like, my book is just not there. And I think the greatest gift it gave me was like more confidence about my writing and my skill.
Talani, we are New Hampshire Public Radio, and I understand that you have spent time here in New Hampshire. Tell us about your time at McDowell.
McDowell was a really amazing experience. I actually got there in, I think it was April of 2024. And when I arrived, I thought I was going to be working on a new project. And then I'd gotten a 15-page edit letter from my editor, like, maybe 2 weeks before. So I was like, oh, this is what I will be prioritizing. But I think it was actually the perfect time and space to be doing such a deep edit on my novel. Like, I think just having the time and space was invaluable, to be honest. It was beautiful in the springtime. The picnic baskets for lunch, like, every day just brought me so much joy. I think also the studio that I stayed in, I think Audre Lorde had stayed in it. maybe Baldwin had stayed in it. I don't know, just the vibe of like all of these writers whose works I've read and like really appreciated being, having been in this environment. McDowell was for me probably an experience that let me take myself more seriously as an artist.
Talani, thank you so much for joining me. I loved having you here today on Check This Out.
It was such a pleasure. I really had so much fun in this interview. Thank you.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You have been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by C&S Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thank you so much for listening. Read on.